Perek Zion.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. So I kind of have to reorient ourselves to where we're at. So,
but I have to tell you, it felt really good because Ruthie, you heard. You heard.
Since we're only four people, why don't you move up?
What's her name?
Why don't you move up? It's only four of us.
Nechama, and I have to tell you, it did jar. Different things from Shmuel.
Oh yeah.
That may I didn't remember everything, but it did. There was a lightning bolt, you know, like there was something.
Yeah.
It's nice that you learned something that you could relate to it.
So we spent a good deal of time talking about the beginning of the Perek, first couple of psukim. We talked about Shmuel, the people's kind of spiritual rejuvenation, their awakening to the fact that the Mishkan was destroyed, and ultimately Shmuel, who leads them on a kind of national campaign of tshuva, removal of the idolatry, get rid of the Baal and Ashtoreth. And I think the last class we had, we talked about how, even though the description of Shmuel's efforts to cleanse the land of idolatry is described here as one verse, but clearly both in terms of the depth of how much he succeeded, as well as the references that we have in, we looked at the Pasuk in Sefer Malachim, or Sefer Divrei Hayamim, where it talks about the comparison between Yoshiyahu's effort to cleanse the land of idolatry hundreds of years later, and compares it to Shmuel, the Korban Pesach that he brought. So all of this is part of the background. There she is. All of this is part of the background to the rest of the parak. Meaning that once we understand that Shmuel succeeded in engaging in this national, fundamental process of getting rid of the idolatry, changing the culture, reinvigorating the people towards Avodas Hashem, the next piece of it is sort of a culmination of all of that coming together and leading us into the counter battle with the Plishtim, which we'll see in a moment. But I want to go back to Pasuk Gimel for one phrase. Shmuel said to the people, if wholeheartedly you return to God, remove the false gods from amongst you, the Baal, the Ashtoret, hachinu levavchem al Hashem v'yivdu levado, serve God alone. We talked about the uniqueness of that idea, that you serve God exclusively. V'yatzel etchem miyad plishtim. And God will save you from the hands of the plishtim, which means that what we need to recognize and not miss in this conversation is that the people are still, as many years later as it is, the people are still living under the hands of or the oppression of the Plishtim. So that the threat of the Plishtim is still very much a part of the consciousness of the people. And when Shmuel leads the campaign of Tshuva, it's not without a recognition that part of this is to kind of reverse the fate that had been thrust upon them in the aftermath of the battle of Evin Ezer, when they lost the Aron and the Plishtim took over the land. So even though we sort of focus more on the spiritual side of it, that piece of it, that political, military piece of it, is very much part of the background for the people and part of Shmuel's background also. He's keenly aware that in the end, in order to get back to nation building, you have to both address the spiritual side of it, but also, talking about the sovereign nation of Israel and the land of Israel, but also the political and military side of it. You've got to be able to deal with the Plishtim. You cannot achieve a kind of spiritual independence if you are unable to remove the political oppression of foreign power. There's just too much congruence and connection between foreign influence politically and foreign influence spiritual. So those two things are interconnected. And where we see that is in the next, is the rest of the parak. So that's sort of the background of the introduction to what comes next. So let's go, now we're jumping to Pasuk He. Pasuk, verse 5. Same chapter, just two psukim later. Vayomer Shmuel, kivtzu et kol Yisrael hamitzpata, ve'et palel ba'adchem al Hashem. Shmuel then turns to the people after this process of tshuva. There's that space, that pause, that paragraph break that indicates that there's a period of time here. And Shmuel turns to them and says it's time to get together in Mitzpeh. Now, Mitzpeh is an interesting place. Every hilltop in Israel could be called Mitzpeh. And in modern Israel, most hilltops in Israel that have any kind of settlement are called Mitzpeh blank. Mitzpeh, Rimon, Mitzpeh, right? You name it. Because that's what Mitzpeh means. It means a place from which you can sofeh, from which you can see the hill.
Scout.
Or scout. There's a. We've seen a number of battles that have started from Mitzpeh, not always the same one. There's a whole discussion as to which one of these places is called Mitzpeh. But it's pretty clear that he's in Shevet Binyamin, or in the territorial expanse of the area of Binyamin. Mitzpeh is classically by near Beit El. I'll show you the map in a moment. Va'et palel ba'adchem el Hashem. I will pray on your behalf to Hashem. Why does Shmuel have to pray on their behalf?
Because they're going to war.
They will eventually go to war, but they're not going to war now. They're not going to war yet. In other words, they're not gathering for the intention of going to war. That is perhaps in the background, but not. We'll see. The war begins as a reaction to their gathering, not as a response to it. The gathering isn't a response to the war. The war is a response to their gathering at Mitzpeh. But why would he need to pray on their behalf?
For their sins.
What does it mean for their sins? What is that? Sounds a little odd.
They're trying to start over.
Aren't they in danger from external influences?
They're in danger from the police demand from external influences. Question is, and they've been doing all of this tshuva building in Sukkim Gimel and Dalet. The role of Shmuel to pray on their behalf et palel ba'adchem is an interesting question. What is the role of tefillah in Tanakh overall? How much do the people pray versus how much do their leaders pray on their behalf? And you find in Tanakh, certainly in this period of history, there isn't any kind of formal context of tefillah. There is a voda context, Mishkan slash Mikdash slash Mizbeach, altar related. And so there are rituals related to the avoda per se, but formal prayer doesn't exist. So tefillah, as a kind of communication between man and God, isn't necessarily the domain of the individual Jew, or the individual Israelite.
Have you Urim v'Tumim still involved at all?
There is a Kohen Gadol, there are Urim v'Tumim, but even the Urim v'Tumim isn't a function of tefillah. Tefillah, we find in Tanakh, in a very unique context. It's an interesting observation altogether, that what we call tefillah is not at all, well, it's related, but it's not the same context as where we find tefillah in Tanakh. Tefillah in Tanakh is a form of communication between God and man. But who communicates between God and man? Who communicates with God, generally speaking?
Nevi'im.
And so what we find often in Tanakh is that the Navi is put into the role of the one who is engaged in tefillah on behalf of. And that on behalf of can mean on behalf of anyone. But it's usually the role of the Navi to be involved in this kind of communication. Soloveitchik in a number of places talks about the fact that Nevuah and tefillah are two sides of the same dialogue. The tefillah is man talking to God, and Nevuah is God talking to man. And then in the time of Tanakh, communication between God and man was always a dialogue. And you had two sides to that dialogue. Nevuah, tefillah. Nevuah, tefillah. And the very first time we ever find the word Navi in Tanakh, the very first reference to the word Navi in Tanakh is in Chumash. Anybody know where?
Moshe.
Oh.
Is it Rivka?
No. The very, very first time we find the word Navi in Tanakh is in Bereshit. A quick glance. Perek Chaf, chapter 20. In the story of Abraham going to Avimelech, Melech Grar, the Eretz Plishtim, and Avimelech, it's the second time that Sarah is taken by the foreign king. First time was Paro in Mitzrayim. Second time is Avimelech, Melech Plishtim. And there, starting with Pasuk Vav, God comes to Avimelech in a kind of a dream. Vayomer elav ha'elokim b'chalom. God spoke to him in a dream, saying, Gam anochi yadati ki betom levavcha asita zot. I know that you were innocent when you took this woman. V'achsoch gam anochi otcha mechatoli. I have prevented you from sinning to me. The Medrash says that there was some sort of a plague that afflicted them. Al kein lo natati chalingoa elea. I didn't let you touch her. However, again, chapter 20, verse 7, Bereshit, V'ata hashev e'eshet ha'ish. Return this wife to this man. Ki navihu v'yitpalel ba'adcha v'chye. He's a navi. Let him pray for you that you may live. And if not, you'll know that you will die. So then, that's the cat's out of the bag. Avimelech calls over Abraham, and the rest of the story is. But there's that moment where he says to him, return Sarah to Abraham, so that he can pray for you to be spared this nega that's afflicted this whole household. Ki navihu. Itpalel ba'adcha. He's a navi, let him pray. The association between the Navi and the Yitpalel, that the Navi's role isn't just to communicate with God, but also, not just to hear God, but also to converse with God, the Yitpalel. And that tefillah can be for himself, but more often than not, it's for somebody else. Moshe praying on behalf of Klai Yisrael after Chayta Ego. Moshe praying on behalf of Israel after Chayta Meraglim. There's a constant theme of tefillah in Tanakh that it's on behalf of the people, a person, a family. Elisha prays on behalf of the woman who gives him room and board. She says, right? Isha Shunamit. It's a constant theme of the Navi, whose role it is to pray on our behalf. Actually, an interesting reference. Who else does Abraham pray on behalf of? Stone. And the next time we find Abraham engaged in tefillah is on behalf of the people of Stone. Completely out of context right there. It's a completely foreign city, unrelated at all to Jewish life, to the descendants of Abraham. But that's part of his role, which is to pray on behalf of. That actually is earlier. It's actually an earlier chapter, though the word Navi there doesn't apply. But to take a look at that chapter for a moment, chapter 18. If you look in verses, starting with Psukim Yud Zayin. This is just before Hashem sends the Malachim out to destroy Sodom, just before the conversation between Abraham and God over the fate of Sodom. There's a couple of psukim in which the Torah interjects God's kind of deliberation, as it were, over why he should tell Avraham what's going to happen. And the Pasuk says, Vashem Amar, God said. He said in his to himself, kind of as if it's described, Kaviyach. Hamechaseh ani me'Avraham asher ani oseh. Am I going to hide from Avraham that which I'm going to do? Ve'Avraham ayo yiyeh l'goy gadol ve'atzum ve'nivruchu v'kol goyah haaretz. Avraham is going to be a great nation, and blessed through him shall be all the nations of the world shall be blessed. Ki yeda'ativ, I have made myself known to him, or I have chosen him. L'man asher yitzavet banav et beto acharav v'shamlu derech Hashem lasot tzedaka u'mishpat. In order that he should instruct his children and his household after him to guard the way of God and to do justice and righteousness. L'man avia Hashem al Avraham at asher diber alav. V'yomer Hashem zakat zedom v'amorak ki lebav v'chazatam ki kavda ma'od v'yaradana v'yarea k'tzakata ba'a elai asu kala v'im lo eida'a. So God said, the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great. I'm going to go down and see what is going on. And that statement is to Avraham. In other words, the statement, Vayomer Hashem, is to Avraham. This is what he tells him. I'm going to go and destroy Sodom. To which Avraham immediately responds, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Vayigash Avraham Vayomer, Ha'af Tispet Tzadikim Rasha. You're going to destroy the righteous together with the wicked. In other words, the conversation between Avraham and God over the fate of Sodom starts with a deliberation of God internally to Kaviyachal to himself, saying, I can't hide this from Avraham, I have to tell him so that he knows about it. He's going to know how to instruct his children to do that which is just and right, and to know that there are consequences and accountability to our actions. And God and Avraham's immediate reaction or response to it. And God speaks to Avraham, tells him, and Avraham's response is
to speak back to
pray on their behalf. Nevuah, tefillah. The terms aren't there, the words aren't used, but the structure is there. Nevuah, tefillah. Nevuah and tefillah are interconnected. It's a communication, it's a dialogue. So the Rav used to say that after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, when we lost the power of Nevuah, that didn't mean that we lost the power of communication with God. We just reshifted it so that instead of a two-sided communication, we have a one-sided communication. We talk, God listens. But communication from God via Nevuah ends with the destruction of the temple. But the two are inherently interconnected. So that... with that background, we now look at the beginning of our story, back to Shmuel chapter 7. Yeah, you're going to go too far. You need to, Shmuel is the beginning. So, there you go.
Rabbi, what happened to all our Tanakh? Because, like, yes,
that is a good question.
There's not 1, 2, 3, 4, there's 5 here. We used to have a lot more.
I had.
That is a very good question.
We had like 7 or 8, didn't we?
Yeah.
We had like 10, I thought.
We had a whole shelf.
We had a whole shelf.
The whole shelf's empty. That is a good question.
We only have 5 here.
Are there any around?
I thought maybe you were, you know, you took them somewhere. Or, I don't know.
Not I. That is a very good question.
Unless someone picked it up and put it somewhere else.
Because it came, you know, yesterday at our class, it came up like, you know, there were 6 of us, and there were no more in the Chumash.
Wow.
I mean, there was that red one, so I just used the red one.
That is an excellent question. No idea where they went. If they were borrowed, they weren't borrowed of my knowledge. Okay, we will investigate. In the meantime, back to Shmuel Aleph Perek Zion, chapter 7. ויאמר שמואל פסוק ה' ויאמר שמואל קיבצו את כל ישראל למצפתה ואתפלל בעדכם על השם. I will pray on your behalf. This is where it all begins.
But can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. If that was like typical mode that the Navi prayed for people, mm-hmm. is that like extra words by saying that? Or that's a gift?
No, this is, he's now gathering all them all together into one big assembly so that he can Now that they've done
but
tshuva.
That was the standard mode, in other words, from this is what would be appropriate, the next step.
He's going to pray on their behalf. He's going to defend them to God. God was angry. He's right, all the terrible things they've done, 400 years of idolatry. They've gotten rid of the idolatry. Very similar to Moshe, right? After the idolatry of Chet Egel, Moshe stood and prayed on their behalf. There is, if we have time today, we'll get to it. There's a whole host of comparisons between Moshe and Shmuel. Moshe and Shmuel probably have two personalities in Tanakh that have the most in common in terms of the references that the Navi wants us to see, compare and contrast. When we will, Bezrat Hashem, do that. But if you sort of want to start making a list of all the comparisons between Moshe and Shmuel, right, this is a classic. After all of the effort to get rid of idolatry, the people were almost destroyed in Eben Ezra in the battle with the Plishtim. Moshe prays on their behalf, or Shmuel prays on their behalf, like Moshe did after Chaytay. Vayikavtzu ha-mitzbata. They gather in mitzbah. Vayishavu mayim vayishpachu lifnei Hashem. Vayatzumu bayom ahu. They drew water, poured it before God. Vayatzumu, they fasted. Vayamru sham chatanu la-Hashem. They said, we have sinned. Vidui. Vayishpot Shmuel et bnei Yisrael b'mitzbah. Shmuel judged Israel in Mitzpeh, which either means he was appointed as the judge, or he led them, or he was, you could see his leadership role. Unclear what the term Vayishbot is. I'm curious about the water.
Yeah.
Oh, curious about this water. Vayishavu mayim vayishpachu lifnei Hashem. They drew water and poured it out. It does sound like Nisach HaMayim, right?
Yeah.
Sounds very much like this, the water libation of the temple, of which there was a great celebration. There are very few references to this idea that outside of the mandate to pour water in the Mikdash once a year on Sukkot, normally there were wine libations on the altar. The water libation was only done on Sukkot, but this idea of drawing water and pouring it before God is a curious one. So I'll show you what some of the Mefarshim do with it. If you look at the first reference, which is the Targum. The Targum is the Aramaic translation of Chumash based on a kind of Midrashic perspective. Rashi and the Mefarshim quote Targum often, but I'll read it and translate it. It's in the Aramaic, so you have to kind of figure out what's literal translation and what's interpretive. Ve'itknishu limitzpaya, they gather together at Knesset. They gather together in mitzvah. Ushfichu libhon bityufta. They poured out libhon.
Their heart.
Their heart. Excellent.
Lev.
They poured out their heart in tshuva. Kimaya, like water. Kadam Hashem before Hashem. So what did the Targum do? Bothered by the reference to pouring water, which has no context here, Targum re-shifts the meaning to not pouring out water before God, but rather pouring out their hearts like water. Right? To pour out one's heart, which is an idiomatic expression, right, would come from this idea. To pour out your heart like you would pour out water.
Sounds like what we say for Sukkot. When we're talking about Tal or whatever.
Right.
Or
Sukkot would be Geshem.
Yeah.
Right. But there's a lot of connection with water in Sukkot overall because of the water libations in the Mikdash. But there they actually pour water over the
But pouring the hot side is sort of, it's like tshuva still.
Right. It's part of the tshuva. And this certainly is part of the tshuva. This is what's being described. The people gathered in Mitzpeh. They drew water and poured out the water before God. They fasted and they said, we have sinned to God. So where's the what's this water doing in the middle of all of this? So therefore the Targum understood it to be a kind of metaphorical or idiomatic expression. They poured out their hearts like water. If you look at Rashi, Rashi quotes this medvish. Tigem Yonatan ushfichu libahon b'tiyufta kemaya kadam Hashem. But also recognizing that, from a pshat perspective, it's a hard explanation to justify. Because?
It's not the same word.
It's not in the text. It's not the same word. And therefore, Rashi offers a second interpretation. Ulefi mashma'o. Mashma'o means the literal reading of the word. Eino ela siman hachna'a. It's a symbol. It's a symbolic act that demonstrates hachna'a. Hachna'a means... No, that's hachana. Hachna'a is... Vayikana libo is to...
It's like... but like...
Submission.
Submission, right.
To submit themselves to God's authority. We are like this water that is being spilt out. We are yours to command. We are loyal to you. It's kind of a symbolic act of submission.
But in the same sentence it says, they poured out before Hashem and fasted.
They fasted, they said, we have sinned before you, all expressions of tshuva, right? They're all symbols of tshuva.
They drew water and afflicted themselves by not using it.
Is that interesting whether the drawing the water and then the fasting are connected in some way? That's an interesting idea. Draw the water but not drink it. Pour it out. Say, we're not drinking or eating. Also an interesting idea. There is a sense of... in all of this, a recognition of God's authority. So Rashi understands that the process of tshuva, and what you're suggesting of also would fit in that context, all related to the notion of a recognition of God's authority in the world. It's interesting that water is the symbol of this discussion, because water, and part of which just came out of Sukkot, so this is a very appropriate context and conversation for Sukkot. Why is there all of this focus on water in the holiday of Sukkot? The Arba Minim, the species that we take, are all water-based species, like the Arava, the Arba Nachal. The prayers for rain are on Sukkot. The Hoshana Rabbah is all about prayer for rain. The ceremony of the Hoshana Rabbah and the Beit HaMikdash was so central, so critical to the rain requirement, that they created all the rules of the calendar that we have, the Hebrew calendar that we have, all revolve around two anchors, but one of the two anchors is to make sure that Hoshana Rabbah never fell on Shabbat. Because if Hoshana Rabbah ever fell on Shabbat, you couldn't do the ceremony of the Hoshanas in the Beit HaMikdash, and that was life and death. You could not survive if you did not, in their mindset, if you did not pray for rain on Hoshana Rabbah. It was all of this, the water libation was perceived to be a prayer for rain. All of this revolved around the notion that water was a critical component of life. Without water, you can't live. And in Israel, that means rain. Whereas the Canaanite god to which the Canaanites prayed was a fertility god, the god of rain, called Baal, and his consort Ashtoret. The perspective of Torah in that same equation, you're in a land which is dependent upon rain, is to recognize that ultimately rain comes from the same God, the same source of power and authority as everything else. And so water became a very central motif in Avodas Hashem, precisely because if you're acknowledging God's authority, you're abandoning the deities of Baal and Ashtoret, which we just talked about in Pasuk Gimel, right? Baal was a god of rain. You're now coming to God and saying, we are yours, we are loyal to you, we recognize one authority, one God, Evdu Livado. At the core of the land of Canaan is the prayer for rain. So, not impossible to suggest that ultimately that's why water became so central to that moment. Its real fundamental tshuva away from Baal and Ashtoret, it has to somehow recognize that even with regards to rain, which was the domain of Baal and Ashtoret, that was the god of rain, we are acknowledging God's authority. So that water moment, very few references to it in all of Tanakh. I think there's only one other place by David HaMelech, but this. Sort of central to this whole process of tshuva, I think makes sense when you see, you know, the contrast to what they've just abandoned. which is hundreds of years of loyalty to the Canaanite gods of rain, Baal and Ashtar. All right. Which brings us to Pasuk Zayin. Vayishma'u plishtim ki itkabtzu b'nei Yisrael ha-mitzbata. The plishtim heard that Israel gathered together in mitzvah. Now, they didn't hear this through the internet. How do they hear this? What does it mean, they heard? Possibly, but I think that's more dramatic than that.
There were plishtim in the area that saw what we're going
to. Possibly. I think it means it's not hard to hide. Meaning, you've gathered not just your little band of Kohanim, Levim, of a temple-based kind of thing. When you're gathering a mitzvah, several times, Vayomer Shmuel Pasuk Hey, Vayomer Shmuel Kivtzu Et Kol Yisrael Mitzbata. Pasuk Zayin, Vayishmu Plishtim Kitz Kabtzu Bnei Yisrael HaMitzbata. This wasn't a small ceremony. This wasn't a gathering of representative tribes, heads of tribes of Israel. This was a major event. Kol Yisrael, Kol Bnei Yisrael. This was a major event. We have no idea the numbers. We don't know how many people Shmuel gathered in Mitzpeh. But he gathered enough for it to be seen as a gathering of all the tribes of Israel.
Did the plishtim think they were gathering to go to war?
That's exactly what the plishtim thought. Mm. You gather all the people together. And the word Vayishpot in the previous verse, Vayishpot Shmuel b'nei Yisrael b'mitzpah, in the context of that verse means he led them in this process of tshuva, but remember that the word Vayishpot in Sefer Shoftim had a different connotation.
Judge.
Yeah, to judge in Sefer Shoftim was a military role. Here's Shmuel, the people all gather together, the plishtim don't know what they're gathering for, but it doesn't bode well with them, especially at a time when they're in control of the land. The last thing you want as a ruling power is for tens of thousands of young men to gather together in one place. Vayishmu plishtim ki itkabtzu b'nei Yisrael mitzbata vayalu sarnei plishtim el Yisrael. So what do?
They go up.
They go up, meaning?
They
gather. The sarnei plishtim are the heads of the groups within the plishtim, meaning that this is now their offensive. They're going to gather together their armies to disperse the crowd, so to speak, or in this case, to go to war.
Did Shmuel not realize that?
So there's a whole conversation in the in the sort of the amongst the Mefarshim, less so, but in more contemporary conversations about this chapter, was there in Shmuel's mind a kind of ulterior motive to this gathering? He gathers all the people for the final act of tshuva in a place that is kilometers away from the last location they fought against the plishtim. In a very high place with high visibility and profile. Was Shmuel looking for the plishtim to counter for a counteroffensive? I suspect the answer is yes. Because ultimately, what did he say in the previous, in Pasuk Gimel? After all of the tshuva and echinu levavchem, v'ivdu levado, serve God alone, exclusively, etc. For what purpose? Yetzelet chamiyad plishtim. Eventually, we're going to have to deal with the plishtim. We're going to have to launch a counteroffensive. I think he preferred that the counteroffensive start from the plishtim than from himself. But in either way,
here too?
Unlikely. Unlikely. It's less likely their role in these kinds of public gatherings. Vayishmu b'nei Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael heard the plishtim. Didn't take much. You're on the top of the hill. You see the plishtim on the march. Vayir'u miplei plishtim. So they were frightened. Now that is not surprising. Why is it not surprising?
Because they won last time.
Right, the last time they engaged the plishtim, it didn't go well. And then the last time they engaged, the Plishtim was in Perek Dalet. We'd have to do a refresher course in Perek Dalet. But we only did it last year, so it's not so terrible. Right, but last Perek Dalet was when they engaged the Plishtim and they lost. They lost the Aron, they lost the Mishkan, they lost Shila, they lost cities, they lost... That really was the most devastating military defeat of Israel in the hands of anybody, let alone the Plishtim, really since they entered into the land of Israel. It changed the balance of power in the land of Israel for a long period of time. Pasuk Chet. Vayamru v'nei Yisrael el Shmuel. Reaction of the people. And this is critical. What's the reaction of the people? So here they're afraid. The Plishtim are on the march. They've just finished this whole ceremony. Now what words come out of their mouth? What's their reaction? Vayamru v'nei Yisrael el Shmuel. Al tacharesh mimenu. Mizok el Hashem Elokeinu. Shmuel, do not stop your prayer. Do not silence your crying to God, your tefillah, v'yoshi'enu miyad plishtim. He shall save us in the hands of the plishtim. What do they ask Shmuel to do?
Pray.
Continue to pray. We're going to go deal with the plishtim. We're going to go fight. You, Shmuel, your role, you stay here, and you pray. Don't stop.
And they felt confidence in his relationship with God, which they didn't probably have the last time.
Very much so. The last time they engaged the Plishtim, what did they do? How do they engage God in the battle? Last time they fought the Plishtim?
The sons of
Eli, what did they do? They went and they took
the Ark of the Covenant.
Right, they went and they took the Ark. They went and they took the Ark out of the Mishkan. In fact, if you take a quick glance back at Perek Dalet.
They're going to take it with them in battle?
Yeah.
Last time they did.
Moshe
never took the ark.
Oh.
Yeah. There's all discussion about one ark, whether it was the second ark, but certainly not the ark that they took.
Oh, okay.
Take a look in. So that was when they traveled. They traveled, but they never. And there's a discussion whether or not there was a second ark that they took with them into battle, but
okay.
Not the ark of the. Take a look in beginning of Perek Dalet. Vayetzei Yisrael likrat plishtim lemilchama. Israel went out to war against the plishtim. Vayachanu al even ha'ezer uflishtim chanu ba'afek. Right, they're encamped in this place, even ha'ezer and afek. We'll show you where that is in a moment. Vayachu plishtim miyat likrat Yisrael vatitoshem milchama. Vayinagef Yisrael lifnei plishtim. Israel was smitten before the plishtim. Pasuk Gimel. Israel, the people came to the camp. They said to the elders of Israel, said, "Lama negafanu Hashem ayom lifnei plishtim? Why has God made us fall before the plishtim? Nikcha elenu mishilo et aron vit Hashem v'yavo b'kirbeinu. Let us take the aron out of Shiloh." Let it come in amidst v'yavobi kirbeinu. Next few words. V'yoshienu mikaf oyveinu. And it will save us from the hands of our enemies. What will save us? The Aron Brit Hashem. What do they say here? What do they say here? V'yamru b'nei Yisrael u'shmuel al tacharesh mimenu mizok al Hashem alokeinu. Don't stop your prayer for us. Don't stop crying to God before us. He will save us in the hands of the Plishtim. In other words, it's the same mind, it's the same issue. What is going to be responsible, or who is going to be responsible to protect us in the hands of the Plishtim? But whereas in Perek Dalet, their mindset was, oh, we're going to lose this battle, we have to take the Aron with the Kruvim, right? The Kruvim will save us. Whereas here, it's Shmuel praying to Hashem. Right, it's the tefillah to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's a really powerful contrast to what was going on back in Perek Dalet.
That's a big transformation.
Right. And that's the indication that the Rambam has this whole discussion about what is the essence of tshuva. How do you know when a person has really done tshuva? When they're in the same circumstance as they were the first time around and they don't repeat the chet.
Mm-hmm.
The contrast between Perek Dalet and Perek Chet.
Wow.
After the tshuva, it puts B'nai Yisrael in exactly the same circumstances that they were in Perek Dalet. We're even going to name the place of the battle the same name. We'll see that in a moment. And yet, completely different outcome. Precisely because of the process of tshuva in between.
So did Shmuel's role evolve, kind of? I mean, like, if, like when you think of a shofet and a navi, it's a different... The role is so different now.
The role is different. He serves both roles. He serves both roles. One of the few individuals to serve both as the Navi and the Shofet. Even by Devorah, where we typically identify Devorah as the Vishi Shaftat Yisrael, Udvorah HaNevi'ah. But there we spend a great deal of time talking about the fact that in that story, even though she's described as the one who's Shofet and she's described as the Navi, the real Shofet in that story was Barak. Her role was to be the Navi, and his role was to be the Shofet. The only other individual we've ever had in history that combined, we've had a Kohen and Shofet, that was Eli, didn't go well.
That did not work out well.
The only other individual who we've ever had serve both roles as Navi and Shofet, if you think of Shofet as the political military leader and the Navi as the communication with God, the only other person who served both roles was
Moshe.
Correct. Which comes back to the comparison between Moshe and Shmuel. Right, which is going to constantly bring us back full circle all the time. That reference or that comparison to Moshe and Shmuel culminates in this parak. Pasuk Tet, Vayikach Shmuel Tle Chalav Echad Vayalu Ola Kalil Hashem. Shmuel makes a korban, an offering, as a korban Ola to Hashem. It's interesting also by virtue of the fact that Shmuel is a Levi, serving here in the capacity of a Kohen. Part of that being the Mishkan's destroyed. Remember when we talked about Shmuel's role, it can kind of be the anti-Kohen, with sort of the notion that the exclusivity of the Kohuna was corrupted, and therefore Shmuel kind of takes on that role a little bit. But just because we can make this comparison, the only other Levi to ever serve in a Kohen role is
Moshe.
Here we go again.
Right? Oh, we're going to do this a lot. Vayizak Shmuel el Hashem ba'ad Yisrael. Vayaneu Hashem. When Bnei Yisrael go into battle against Amalek. Remember the battle of Amalek?
Yeah, that didn't go well for us.
Right. But who? Well, it did for a period of time, right? Who fought the battle? Who led the battle on the ground?
Yeshua.
And what was Moshe's role?
With his arms up praying.
And with the staff and his arms praying. Right. People are going to battle against the Plishtim. What's Shmuel's role?
He's praying.
He's still on the top of the mountain, Mitzpah.
Yeah.
Right? Praying on behalf of the people. The korban and the tefillah. Vayaneu Hashem. And the parallel is very striking. Vayishmuel ma'ale ola, by Moshe it says that he would lift up his hands. And here ma'ale ola, he would offer this ola korban. Uplishtim nigshula milchama b'Yisrael. And the plishtim attacked Israel. Vayarem Hashem b'kol gadol b'yamahu al plishtim b'yehumim. God made a great noise, confusion amongst the plishtim, confounded them. Vayinagfu. If you want to talk about the contrast, right? You want to talk about the contrast to Perek Dalad, where it says that Israel fell before the Plishtim. Here the Plishtim fell. Take a look at the chart that I gave you on that source page. An interesting. I just a couple of phrases that I compared between Perek Dalad and Perek Zion. So in Perek Dalad it says, "Vayimuzik Neisrael lama nigafanu Hashem." And here it says at the end of Pasuk Yod on the left side, Vayinagful ben lifnei Yisrael. But in Perek Dalet it also said that when the Aron, Pasuk Hey, third column, when the Aaron came into the camp, they cried out to the great Trua, and the land was confounded. By us it says, Hashem bekol gadol plishtim vayumem. So the phraseology is very specific. It's the same terms, but a different subject, different subject of the verbs, and a different outcome completely. That's part of the textual play that Tanakh often does with words. Use the same words, create a contrast, a parallel connection to highlight the contrast and the difference. Vayetzu anshei plishtim, anshei Yisrael min hamitzpah, vayirdefu et plishtim. Israel, right, they came down from this hilltop of Mitzpeh, they chased after the plishtim, vayakum ad mitachat lebetkar, and they chased them all the way to a place called Betkar. I'm not quite sure we know where Betkar is. Vayakach Shmuel Evan Achat, vayasem ben haMitzpeh uben haShen. Shmuel then took a great stone, placed it between Mitzpeh and Shen. Shen is another word for a rock. Vayikra et Shmo. What did he call this rock? Evan Ha'azer. Evan Ha'azer. The rock of?
Help.
Vayomar, and he said, Adhena Azaranu Hashem. Till here, God has helped us. Azaranu Hashem. Play on the word Azer. Now, it's a remarkable moment. Think about it for a second. Evan Ezer is a different place. Evan Ezer, here's a map.
You mean Israel?
Yeah. Here's a map. Okay. If you look at the two black boxes, Evan Ezer Perek Dalet and Evan Ezer Perek Zion. They are in Nachlat Binyamin. They are in the area of Shmuel. Shmuel's hometown is in Shevet Binyamin. They are in, if you look to the right of that black box, you see where it says Mitzpeh?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little hard to read, but it's just south of Beit El, just north of Giv'on. Mm-hmm. Southwest of Giv'on is Kiryat Ye'arim, where the Aron is sitting. You see that on the map?
Mm-hmm.
That's the area where Shmuel's operating. Ofra, Beit El, Mitzpeh, Givon, the cities of Shevet Binyamin. So, if you look at the story as it originally occurs, we had started our focus on Sefer Shmuel in the city of Shiloh.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The battle with the Plishtim took place near Afek, Evan Ezer, Liad Afek. Remember, the Plishtim gathered in Afek and Bnei Yisrael gathered in Mitzpeh, in Evan Ezer. That was on the coast. Because the Plishtim always started on the coast. Do you see the black box on the upper northwest corner?
Probably right near Tel Aviv.
North of Tel Aviv, because here's Yafo.
Yeah.
Okay? Correct. Now, when they went back to Shiloh to take the Aron, went back into battle, lost the Aron, where did the Aron go? Back in Perek Hay, the Aron went south.
To one of the Plishtim.
Mm-hmm. The battle went south, the Aron went south. Yeah, right? Yeah. It went into Eretz Plishtim. Ashdod, mm-hmm. Ashkelon, Gat, Ekron,
Gat, yeah.
Right? All of those cities, at the Aza, all of those cities of the Plishtim down below. Then they sent the Aron back from Gat. Where did they send it back to?
Kiryat Yearim?
Not yet. They sent it back to
Beit Shemesh.
So take a look from Gat,
yeah.
Draw a straight line to Beit Shemesh.
Right.
Now, if you follow from Shiloh the path of the Aron, right? If you follow from Shiloh the path of the Aron, find something very interesting. It starts in Shiloh. From Shiloh, draw a line with your finger from Shiloh to Evan Ezer, the north Evan Ezer, right, where the battle of the Plishtim was. Aron goes south, all the way into Ashdod, Ashkelon, Aza, Gat, and then. Back to Beit Shemesh. What's happened? And from Beit Shemesh and the calamity of Beit Shemesh, it then gets hidden in a city called Kiryat Yearim. And I finished
it's
the.
Like
so it makes a big circle.
Yeah.
The Aron makes a circle. It goes from Shiloh, Devon, Ezer, down to Ashdod, Ashkelon, Azan, Gat, Beit Shemesh, Kiryat Yerim, and there it stays. That circle essentially surrounds the area where Shmuel is now operating, which is Evan Ezer. Beit El, Mitzpeh, Givon. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
That's now the location of the second battle. That's in the heartland. That's in the mountains. If the Plishtim are there, I've said this before, if the Plishtim are there, that means the Plishtim have complete control of the land of Israel. This isn't the coast we're talking about. This is the darker area, which is the mountain. This is where this is the center of Israelite settlement. This is where the Jews are. Beit El, Mitzpeh, Giv'on, Yivus, Yerushalayim, Beit Lechem. This is our home. And from this battle, now it's interesting, Shmuel calls this place, this monument that he builds, he takes a rock, and he names it Evan HaEzer. That's not an accident. Evan Ezer is not here. Evan Ezer was the name of the place where they lost the battle with the Plishtim the first time around in Perek Dalet. Why does he name it Evan Ezer here? So he plays on the word. Evan Ezer was the place where they lost the battle. What does he do now? He's played on a key word, namely
Ezer.
Adhena Azaranu Hashem. What did he say? Adhena Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayamar Adhena Azaranu Hashem. Until here, God's assistance, God's hand has helped us. And in fact, the result of this battle was Vayikan'u Plishtim, just to read on for a moment, Vayikan'u Plishtim. The Plishtim were, it's that same word, Hachna'ah, that we had before. Subdued. V'loyasfu od lavo b'gvu Yisrael. Never again will they come into the land of into the borders of Israel. V'atiyad Hashem b'plishtim koyimei Shmuel. Not only that, not only did the Plishtim lose the battle, but it's a total reversal of everything that they had lost in the Perek Dalet. All of the cities that had come into the hands of the Plishtim in the aftermath of the failure or the loss in Perek Dalet, all of the cities which the Plishtim had taken from Me'et Yisrael now return to Li Yisrael, to Israelite hands. Me'akron. Look at the names of the cities. Me'akron. Ve'adgat. Ve'adgvulan. Itzil Yisrael Mi'ad Plishtim. Ekron and Gat are core cities of the Plishtim. We are now, instead of the Plishtim incursion into the land of Israel, Israel has now taken over cities which were even historically Plishtim. Vayehi shalom ben Yisrael leben ha'emori. The land is quiet. This Evan HaEzer is a remarkable name. It's one of Shmuel's brilliant moments. What does he do? He takes the very name that was symbolic of the failure. It was the name of a battle. It was the name of a city. Everybody knew Evan HaEzer was... You know, you said Evan HaEzer and you trembled because they lost the Mishkan, they lost Shiloh, they lost everything. And he takes a stone, he takes a monument in the aftermath of this great moment of tshuva in the middle of this battle, and he calls it Evan HaEzer. In this case, referring not to the place Evan HaEzer, but to God. It's a monument. It's a matzev. It's like a mizbeach. It's a symbol of Ezrat Hashem. Ad hena Azaranu Hashem. God has helped it. The Ezrat Hashem expression, right? Here, God's hand, helping hand, can be seen. But by playing on the word, Evan Ezer from the first battle to Evan Ezer of the second battle, he's shifted the very symbol of what was the symbol of their destruction into a symbol of their salvation. It's a remarkable shift.
It's interesting how the Goyim used Ebenezer, which is Evan Ezer,
mm-hmm.
for a name, like people would name that.
It's a different thing.
It is?
Completely.
Because we don't use that name.
And
we do.
Perish Rabbi Avram ben Ibn Ezra. It's called Ibn Ezra, right? Oh. Why? That's a different name altogether. Because that comes from the Arabic Ibn,
yeah.
Which means son of.
Ah.
Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra is Rabbi Avraham ben Ezra. Ezra's a name.
Yeah.
So Ibn Ezra is a name. Ben Ezra.
Right.
That's a different issue altogether. This is Evan HaEzer, the stone of victory, the stone of salvation, the stone of God's helping hand. Unlike Evan HaEzer, the first battle, which is just the name of the city, where they lost the battle, now he's switched it around.
So you think Ebenezer is the same kind of thing?
Probably.
The Goyim means?
Oh, I don't know what the Goyim means.
You know, because it's in that Christmas story.
I have no idea.
Ebenezer Scrooge.
I have no idea from those things.
Is that a Dickens?
I don't know who wrote it.
Havdil Elif Alfangal. But I will show you one other thing about the power of the Hebrew language. Just to shift focus for a second. Show you something interesting about the power of the Hebrew language. What does the word hena mean?
Hena? Ad hena?
It says, ad hena azaranu Hashem.
Until this point.
You just said two different things.
Well, it could mean both things.
Meaning?
That it could have, depending on how it's used, it could use, could be a question of up to this point in time, or it could be a geographic location.
Bohena?
Yeah,
come here.
Adhena?
Until now.
Until now. Adhena azaranu Hashem. Until now, God has assisted us. Or, took an Evan, called it Evan HaEzer, and said, Adhena. To
meaning now. Here.
To this point, right? This here. Physical place. Here was God's. The word Hena is a remarkable word because it's a reflection of, or it's an indication of a point in time as well as a point in
place.
It's one of those places, it's one of those moments in the Hebrew language, one of those words in the Hebrew language in which the distinction between time and place gets distorted. Or converge. Hmm. And we find it in several places in Chumash or in Tanakh. One of the most powerful is a pasuk also in Sefer Bereishit, where God's promise to Abraham in the covenant between the parts in the Brit Ben Habtarim, where he says to him that the land of Israel, that you will remain in exile for four generations, Ger Yisrecha be'eretz lo lahem. You will be strangers in a strange land. You will be afflicted for 400 years. Know your children will be strangers in a strange land, slaves afflicted for 400 years. The nation that shall afflict them, I will judge. And then they will come back with great wealth. You will not see any of this. You will be buried in a ripe old age. V'dor revi'i yeshuvu hena. Fourth generation will return
here.
Ki lo shalem avon ha'emori ad hena. Because the iniquity of the Amorites will not be complete until then.
Oh, then.
Till that point. Why do you have to wait four generations? You have to wait four generations for two reasons. Number one, because Israel will have to be in exile for four generations. But number two, because you can't inherit the land of Israel until God is willing to remove the indigenous Amorites, Canaanites from the land because of their sins. But that, right, there's four generations of God's patience with the sins of a generation. This is one of those indications that God's midot, God's attributes of mercy and din and judgment are applicable not only to Israel but also to the nations of the world. God will wait with the Amorites for four generations. And so in one verse, you have the word hena meaning two different things. Dor revi'i yeshuvu hena, the fourth generation will return here. Kilosh Shalem Avone Amori Adhena, because the iniquity of the Amorites will not be complete until then. Here, then. Place and time. Adhena Zaranu Hashem, to what does Shmuel mean? This place is the place where God helped us? Or up until this point, this is a moment in history, this is a turning point in history. God's hand here was assisting us in turning the tides of history. I think the answer is both. But that's the power of the word hena. It's the power of the Hebrew language, which in many places converges time and place. In rabbinic Hebrew, Chazal did the very similar thing, but with a different word. They did the same thing with the word olam, mm-hmm. which in rabbinic Hebrew means olam hazeh, olam haba, which means the world. Really? It's a reference to. It's a olam reference to. Forever. In Tanakh, it means eternity. Uh-huh. The word olam in Tanakh always means eternity. The word olam in rabbinic literature always means world. Olam hazeh, olam haba.
What's the basis for that change?
So that's language changes over time, use of language changes over time. But it's interesting that it's a reference in the same way that Hena has a time and place convergence. The word Olam shifts from a time reference to a place reference. Mm-hmm. And there are other words like that too, but that change over time. But those examples are very powerful because they reflect this sort of philosophical notion that God is outside of the realm of time and space. And there's a connection between them. In my younger days, when I was into the science side of things, space-time kind of concept, this was very powerful for me. So when you find a term reference that links space-time, and Einstein has a field day. So that was a whole different... All right. That is sort of where we were up to today. What I did not get to is the last piece of this, which was the sort of summary conclusion of Shmuel and Moshe's comparison, but that requires the end of this parak. So that, Bezrat Hashem, we will pick up on next week. We'll sort of finish this parak, sort of summarize where this story of Shmuel has taken us.
Novel to have 2 weeks in a row.
Novel to have 2 weeks in a row. Yeah, there you go. Now we're going to have lots of weeks in a row.